What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blandford, and today I'm talking to Chuck. So I've been in ministry maybe a little over a decade now, and I come across a lot of pastors. I'm friends with some pastors, and one thing that I've heard in most stories that I've listened to of other pastors is there's a lot of trauma in being a pastor. Like, churches tend to like hurt pastors, people who work for them. And a lot of that is because of narcissism of maybe somebody at a high level in a church. And I think you've seen over the years, you know, some really big sort of blow ups at churches and just pastor like moral failings and just sort of all this abuse going on. And it's just like sad. It's just so sad. And we've journeyed, JJ and I have journeyed with a few people through this sort of thing. And it's really, really hard to explain how a place where you're supposed to be safe can hurt you. And so what Chuck has done is entered into this space in a lot of ways, a very complicated, difficult, heavy space, and has a book called When Narcissism Comes to Church. And so his book is about how narcissism sort of manifests itself in church context and then how one can heal from those sort of things. And so I think this is a really valuable resource to the church. This is a great episode. Chuck talks through a lot of great stuff and just like great concepts and ideas, even what narcissism is. That's a word we really throw around in our culture. And I think talking about what that actually is from a clinical perspective and also just from a life perspective and what narcissism looks like is really helpful. So you're going to love hearing about that, hearing about healing, hearing a little bit about trauma and all of that sort of stuff. And so it's a great episode. Before I launch this episode, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle and on Twitter at Curry Blandford to stay up to date with the awesome stuff we got going on at the podcast. Yeah, make sure you're doing all that. And I hope you really enjoy hearing from Chuck. Well, Chuck, I just can't say thanks enough for coming on the show with me and chatting a little bit. It's fun.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Let's just jump off here and just have you give the sort of rundown of just who you are.
Who am I? Good question. So right now, just professionally, what I'm doing is I teach at a seminary. I teach pastoral care and Christian spirituality courses. I was a pastor for a long time, and in many ways, I'm still a pastor to my students and to people in the community. But I'm also a clinical therapist, so that's another hat that I wear. But I've been married to Sarah for 25 years. We've got two daughters, 18 and 17, and we've done two cross-country moves from Orlando to San Francisco and San Francisco to Holland, Michigan.
Wow.
And so we've had kind of a fun journey.
That's wild. That's wild. So Holland, Michigan, I love Holland so much. That is an amazing city.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. You know, coming here from San Francisco for the first year or so, I didn't change my, my like Twitter location because I was like, I'm in West Michigan. I'm not sure about this, but yeah, I love it. It's been fantastic. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, we went there there was a wedding. One of our youth group kids went to what's the other school in Holland? Is it
Hope College?
Hope. I get them all confused. Grace, Hope, you know, yeah, but Hope. And so we've got to like hang out in the city and stuff, and it is like beautiful.
It's a great little city. Yeah, right on Lake Michigan. Yeah.
Yeah. You're right across the lake from us. I'm out in Wheaton, Illinois. So, you know, it's just right there.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So we both know dreary days with no sunshine. Yeah.
That is very true.
Yeah.
And I have three small children in the house. So it's like perfect, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Great time for a pandemic.
Yeah. Right. Crazy. Crazy. Okay, so let's jump on your story train here a little bit, and just because I know you spent time in vocational ministry and then, you know, have been a clinician for a long time. Can you just sort of like trace that out a little bit?
Yeah, so I started out in ministry in the mid-90s, and very early on in that journey, really came to a point where I had to face my own stuff, my own story, my own brokenness, my own pain, how I come off to other people, how I impact people. And so in the late 1990s, I got into therapy and went through a mental health counseling program. which was pretty transformational. That's when, at least in terms of this narcissism stuff that we're talking about, that's when I began seeing narcissism, not just in the church communities that I was in, but as a therapist too. Mm-hmm. So I've actually started 2 church-based counseling centers, and one in Orlando and one in San Francisco. And so I've done a lot of pastoral counseling work and a lot of clinical counseling work, but also for the last probably 12 to 15 years now, assessments of pastors, which is another piece that alongside consulting with churches has really exposed me to narcissism at a whole new level, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So, so why like narcissism? I mean, I know you saw it everywhere, but like, what is it that sort of like, yeah, made you go down that path, I
yeah,
guess.
Yeah. Why would I write a book on narcissism? I like talking about other things better than this. I've written a few other books, and my last one, Wholeheartedness, is what I talk about the most. I love to talk about wholeheartedness and our journey to wholeness and lead retreats. It was probably within the last 5 years or so with some of the consulting work that I've been doing. I had a number of pastors, in fact, say to me, what are good resources to understand narcissism in the church? And I had some like general resources, and some were older. But there wasn't anything that we could all come up with, even as I like got with mentors and asked them, there wasn't anything that we could come up with that really kind of summarized it well and was kind of a clear diagnostic and pathway to healing. And so my friends challenged me to write it, and I said no for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And then I just had the sense that, yeah, maybe that is the call. Maybe it's time to do that. I wrote the book.
Yeah.
One of the issues you first bring up with narcissism is that it's a word that we like really throw around pretty nonchalantly, right? Can you talk a little bit about, because there's, and I understand the DSM-5 that sort of outlines all these personality disorders like has changed even from the fourth version. And, you know, so there's like clinical diagnoses, but then there's also like, yeah. Can you just untangle that a little bit, I guess?
Yeah, that's right. Because we have our caricature of narcissism, right? And and so if someone's grandiose or kind of arrogant or egocentric, we say he's a narcissist or she's a narcissist. And we do this with politicians, and we do this with celebrities and pastors, et cetera, right? So there's like the definition that comes from the psychology world that talks about grandiosity, talks about a lack of empathy, talks about impairments of identity and intimacy. That just basically means that there's volatility in relationships or in work. I try to nuance it a little bit more because I see it in what I call the 9 faces of narcissism. When you begin to drill down on narcissism, it's not just grandiose. There are versions of it that we call like a vulnerable kind of narcissism that's kind of like shy and insecure and passive aggressive, but it's just as manipulative and entangling. And so it's important for us to kind of distinguish and delineate between the grandiose and the vulnerable narcissism, and then to talk about how it shows up in like 9 different styles that sometimes looks like the person on stage, but oftentimes doesn't look like that person.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciated that. Cause you go through the entire Enneagram, you know, the 9, Enneagram, and talk about how each of those types like manifest narcissism, which I, really appreciated. I'm a 3. And so I feel like when I see somebody who's like narcissistic, you know, classic example, I'm like, well, they're definitely a 3, which is, you know, not like appropriate at all, but it's just, that's the personality that seems most likely to end up being that, I guess.
Yeah. And that's what people say. When I ask, they'll say Enneagram 3, Enneagram 8.
Right.
Interestingly, Claudio Naranjo, so if you know anything about the Enneagram, he's like the early psychologist that kind of bridged kind of the Latin American world and us and up here in North America. And he says that the 7 is the archetypal narcissist because the 7 is always kind of out looking for the next adventure, the next thing, disconnected from the present moment, living in a kind of fantasy. But then I start talking about I see narcissism or narcissistic traits, at least in an Enneagram 9. In an Enneagram 6, in a 4, And if I could, just one quick clarification on this too.
Yeah.
It's important, and you asked about this earlier, but I didn't make it clear. When we talk about narcissism, sometimes we're talking about narcissistic traits. And, you know, I have narcissistic traits. You maybe have I would say anyone who gets up and speaks on behalf of God for a living probably has some narcissistic traits.
Correct.
You know?
Yeah.
That's very different than narcissistic personality disorder, right, which we need to do via like a clinical assessment and some real work, you know, in therapy to actually assess well, right? So when we talk, like you talked about earlier, kind of more generally about narcissism, you know, that's where we sometimes get a little bit messed up in kind of our like, are we talking about NPD, the disorder, or are we talking about Chuck just has some narcissistic traits?
Right, right. Well, there's a whole list of those too, like borderline personality disorder. I know my wife's a clinician, so I have like some interaction with like I have like enough to be dangerous, you know, sort of.
Right, right.
But and this is a nuance that you have in the book that I really appreciated. We are so binary. We love to just like straight up just label people. It makes it a lot easier, right?
It makes it so much easier. And if I have a label, I have power over you, you know?
Right.
I know for me early on, after a couple of different experiences of being hurt or feeling hurt by others, doing this mental health counseling program gave me labels for people. So you're a borderline and you're a narcissist and you're histrionic and you're an addict. And that's a problem, you know, because when we start doing that, we get kind of disconnected from our own brokenness, our own stories, right, our own complicity in these things, you know?
Yeah.
So I think to do this kind of work, we need some humility. I'm hoping that people hold the book with humility in the diagnostic categories. This is not about like, oh, no, now I have a book to diagnose all my friends.
Right, right.
It might help with that. But it also, you might also walk away saying, well, how do I live this out in particular kinds of ways?
Yeah, I think that's good. And I kept reading the book and being like, oh, crap. There's traits of narcissism here and here and here, you know. But I think even with like the Enneagram, how it's sort of like blown up, right? It's our natural tendency to be like, well, they're obviously whatever it is. And like, you know, it's so dangerous to put those labels on people because you box them in. Yeah?
That's right. Anyone who's a mega church pastor has got to be a narcissist, right?
Right.
Or anyone.
Right.
And one of the things that I talk about in there is like, I know small church, I'm talking like 30, 40, 50 person church pastors who are like, we're the pure church. We're the special church. We're God's elect. They don't have it figured out. We have it figured out. They're not theologically pure. We're theologically pure. And that's a kind of subtle form of narcissism just as well.
Yeah. And can go unchecked just as easily. Right.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. Right.
Let's talk narcissism in the church then. I don't even know sort of where to begin here. Why don't you talk about sort of right? It's such like a huge topic, you know? Why don't we talk about the maybe uptick that you've seen in the church, or like, how about I let you start? Can you talk about narcissism in the church?
I love it. So where do we start? Yeah, right. So this is the hard thing, because I think a lot of people start with their own experiences, right? And I mean, I can give you all kinds of categories and definitions and stuff like that. But let's just start with the reality that I hear often from people. And that's that I feel crazy. One of the main things that I say when I talk about the book is, if it does nothing else, I hope that people walk away from it feeling like maybe I'm not crazy. Maybe I'm okay. And what I mean by that is that when you're under narcissistic leadership, you're sort of made to feel crazy. Like there's something wrong with you. The leader is infallible. The leader is, you know, and so I was just talking to someone the other day, and here we are recording this during a time of coronavirus. And there was this pastor trying to get up to speed with, let's get all the technology and let's start doing online worship and let's start doing, you know, regular devotions, and was sending out this particular person who I was talking to get all the equipment, and they were exasperated and they were getting like the wrong things, and he was getting more, but he was staying home with his family and to be safe. Right. And she's going out to like Best Buy and all these different stores. And, and she said, you know, I just feel like I'm not doing a good enough job. I don't feel like I'm working hard enough. And that was a situation where it was crazy making for her, because he'd come back to her and say, how come you can't get this right? And in the meantime, he's not contributing at all. And she's feeling like she's not efficient or not competent or capable. And that's really painful. I'm not saying that her boss is a narcissist, but I was detecting some of those dynamics here. And so in the book, I talk about emotional and spiritual abuse. And it's really important to think about how narcissism impacts us and traumatizes our bodies. I know, like the other night, I woke up at 3 a.m., couldn't get back to sleep, and I was kind of anxious, and I was trying to figure out what was going on. Lo and behold, I get back to some stuff that happened probably almost 20 years ago now in ministry, and it was like, oh, yeah, I'm talking a lot about narcissism these days, and it's peaking back up in my in my own experience of being traumatized. So I think, yeah, a good place to start often is with people's experiences of feeling crazy or feeling emotionally abused or feeling isolated or excluded or all the different dynamics that I talk about in the book. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. You brought up just even the kind of the body keeps the score, but that trauma has like these physical manifestations, and that like, I feel like a lot of times maybe we're disconnected even from our own bodies, or it's hard to listen to our bodies sometimes.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I mean, that feels so important right now. And you know, that conversation, your wife's a clinician. You guys know this. I mean, that's a newer conversation. I was not trained in trauma in my counseling program 20 years ago. And so the reality is you're right. The body keeps the score says it well. We internalize pain, abuse, loss in our life, all sorts of different things in ways that lead us to lead our autonomic nervous system to react in particular kinds of ways, fight, flight, freeze, fawn, right? In ways that could be reactive and maybe even self-sabotaging and self-destructive. And so as we pay attention to our bodies, we realize, oh, that impacted me a whole lot more than I thought it did. Right. But it's amazing how much we can sort of push down and repress. You know, like I counseled a man who was on staff with a narcissistic pastor for 6 years. And during that time, he couldn't have told you that there was something wrong. Right. Even though there was a part of him, like instinctually, that knew this is really messed up. But he was like the frog in the boiling pot that just kept getting hotter and hotter and hotter, right? And
yeah.
And then he woke up one day and he's like, ouch, this hurts really bad. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I'm sure those effects lasted for a long period of time, right? Like even coming back, you know?
Yeah. And still, I mean, this ends up being work that goes on for a long time. And if you talk to... And this is what I'm starting to hear as the book is kind of getting out there, as people are coming back and saying, my story goes back 7 years ago. My story goes back 10 years ago. I'm in it right now. And then you start to hear the stories of pain. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so hard. It's so hard to, I walk through similar stories with some pastors, you know, friends of mine. I mean, it's in my estimation, I think it's rare to come across somebody who's been in vocational ministry for very long, who hasn't interacted with some of these things from leaders in the church.
That's right. I mean, I think it's pervasive. I've been hesitant to use this language because it's what we're going through right now. But for a long time, I called it an ecclesial pandemic, you know,
right.
Meaning that it's all over the place. It's in many of our churches. You probably can't get away from it. There are healthy churches, to be sure.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I've got some friends in pastoral ministry who I'm so grateful for, who are leading in healthy ways. But if you're in ministry for any period of time, you're going to come across this.
Yeah.
And I talk often in the book about narcissism's bite. And you don't know it until it bites you on the butt, you know, and you're like, ouch, what was that? Oh, you know, so I've been working really hard to please my pastor for the last 6 months. And I made one comment, pushed back on one suggestion of his, and now I'm out. Now he hasn't talked to me for the last week. So that's it, right?
Right. So what is it about the church that sort of like facilitates this sort of narcissism?
Oh, goodness. That's a great question. And I feel like that's a really complicated question because people will often ask, is this a new phenomenon? And I'm like, no. Do you know the history of the the popes and the bishops and the abuse of the church in Christendom, you know, how we failed to show up in ways that we did in the first centuries of the church as humble and self-sacrificing. I think anywhere, I think this begins in Genesis chapter 3, right? Mm-hmm. So I think this is the Tower of Babel. This is David and Solomon. It's all over the place, right?
Right.
And so,
right.
This is egocentric Peter, wondering who's loved most and how he compares. And so,
right.
And that's not to say, you know, I'm not trying to retrospectively diagnose Peter with narcissistic personality disorder. This issue of egocentricity in the church goes back a long way. And so, at its core, as I talk about, it's rooted in shame. It's fundamentally this sense of, I can't trust anyone but me. I can't trust you, God. I'm not sure that you're enough. And then sort of paradoxically, I'm not sure that I'm enough. You know, the narcissist doesn't begin one day thinking, I want to rule the world, you know?
Yeah.
It begins with the story of being bullied in his, you know, fourth and fifth grade years, and subconsciously, you know, erecting defense mechanisms and systems and self-protective walls that, you know, now that he's 45 years old, he's the bully.
Yeah.
And so with that in mind, I mean, any era, any decade, any time in the history of the church, we're all susceptible to this, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, because there is a story there, right? I mean, yeah, I was just listening to a podcast the other day, and this person was lamenting that we no longer call bad bad and good good, right? Because like we see this, you know, we have a trauma perspective, and so you know, because we can sort of understand maybe where somebody's narcissism comes from, that means that like we no longer see them as bad or something. Do you understand the mentality that I'm?
Yeah. And what's tough about that, and I think probably the most controversial piece of what I talk about is there are some who want to say, if you're narcissistic personality disorder, you are wicked, you are bad, and you are incurable. And I want to say, listen, as a clinician, when we're talking about narcissistic personality disorder, we're at that point, we're trying to mitigate damage. We're not talking about significant transformation. Where, you know, my hope is, as was the case maybe a decade ago when I was working with a particular church, get him out of ministry. The guy I'm thinking of got into like real estate or something like that. Like
right.
there hasn't been significant transformation in his relationships. But I also want to say that we're image bearers. We know the divine DNA. We know how people are made. We know that we're made for love and connection with God. We're made to love and be loved by God. And that some people are so buried underneath years and years of pain, brokenness, trauma, abuse, that I do have some empathy. And I know that's crazy to say, and that's hard, but, you know, like I don't say that when I'm in a clinical counseling session with someone married to a narcissistic man or something, or woman, you know, I don't say, well, I have empathy for all narcissists. You know, they're image bearers. I try to be really wise about this, but I think when I'm talking like more generally, I want to say every one of us has a story of pain. Every one of us is hiding something. And that's not to say, not to equalize everyone, you know, and not to say there aren't people who are sinister is the word I like to use,
sure.
You know, so manipulative. I've been hurt by people like this.
Yeah.
It is to say that I think over time we can grow in compassion for even the most broken. And I, in fact, in the book, I use the story of Eddie Hillesum, a Dutch Jew who was died at Auschwitz, was murdered at Auschwitz, right? Who even until her dying day in her journals, because she had done so much transformational work in her own heart and life, could see the image of God even in her captors. And that's a pretty extraordinary thing. Again, I don't require my clients who have been impacted or abused by narcissists to go there on week two or even year two. I'm just saying, it's kind of a fundamental conviction of mine, you know?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I think it speaks to like our inability to sort of hold two things in tension at the same time, which is like, yes, they abuse people. Yes, they're victims and like they need their healing. And at the same time, like there is something going on here and this person can be helped, right? Like,
yeah. Can we hold this with a deadly seriousness and not minimize it at all, you know, and call evil, evil, where we see it, call sin, sin, call abuse, abuse, call abuse of power, and not just an affair, you know, and at the same time, recognize that we're all image bearers. We all have stories. Because if not, we end up in this really binary world where I'm good and you're bad. Any of us who's done any kind of shadow work with ourselves knows that you're going to get down to some layers that are not pretty, and are deeply painful.
Yeah.
And, any one of us who does this work also sees that there's deep egocentricity too, you know? And so, so it's just a way of, engendering some compassion, amidst a lot of pain in this conversation. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's good. It's difficult. And it's difficult to talk about the devastation that some of these, you know, I live in the Chicagoland area. I've had two of the biggest, you know, fallouts from, egocentric pastors in the last, year. I don't even know how long it's been now, but I was reading a blog post on your website about, Jean, I'm going to butcher the last name.
Jean Vanier. Yeah.
Vanier. Do you just mind talking about maybe your personal connection with him and, or just how he's.
Yeah. Well, I've never met him or anything like that. I have some friends who have, and by all accounts, or most accounts, I should say, now we're discovering some other accounts, but by most accounts, he was an otherworldly soul, you know, a saintly soul, and just remarkable in his generosity. Man who started communities for the disabled, mostly people with intellectual disabilities, right? And a man who believed in connection and physical touch and love. And so all these things, while at the same time he violated women by abusing their trust of him. Right. And harming them with a kind of abusive touch, you know, and violating trust at the deepest level. And I think that's the part of this that is crazy making for a lot of us, right? Jean Vanier? Really? Jean Vanier? I mean, and you start to think, like, who are your heroes? You know, now we all have shadow sides, but this was a substantial, like, double life kind of story, right? And I don't know. I don't have the tools to diagnose Jean Vanier as a narcissist, but I now know that he is a far more broken man than any of us thought, right?
Yeah.
That he abused his power, and that changes things pretty drastically, right? But it really, for me, I mean, I used to have, when I was early on in ministry, pictures of all my heroes on my office wall.
Yeah,
I haven't had that up for like the last 15 years. And that was just an instinct of mine a while ago, like, as, you know, as heroes in our culture started falling, you know, and probably as I looked at my own story too, and I don't want people to elevate me either. Right. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's hard. I mean, this work that you do is hard. It's hard to, like, lean into these things, you know?
Yeah.
And as an Enneagram 3, having any emotions whatsoever is hard for me to begin with. So, you know, that, you know, this topic makes it even harder.
Yeah, but I give you a lot of credit for, like, as a 3, you know, leaning into the kinds of conversations that you lean into, which tells me that you've done inner work, right? And that's my hope for this kind of work, you know, is that we all engage our own stories and we all grow so that we can't, like, just because you call yourself an Enneagram 3, I can't caricature you no more than I'd want you to caricature me as a 4. Like, oh goodness, he's a 4. This guy is going to be a wreck on this podcast, you know? You know, whatever it might be.
Right. Yeah, totally. I'm seeing a spiritual director, which has been, just, like, really, really good for me, in so many ways. But there's still just such hesitancy in our culture around the shadow, exploring that shadow self, like you talk about.
Such hesitancy. And I think probably we're just scared, you know, if we're honest, we're just scared of what we'll find there as we do the digging. I can't say how many times I've worked with pastors who we've started to get there, you know, then they've come in, they said, I'm dealing with a little depression or anxiety, and we'll get to some deeper stuff. And they'll say, yeah, that's enough.
Right.
And that makes me really sad. Or churches too, where we'll start doing some digging on, you know, church systems, which I talk a lot about in the book. And, you know, they'll be like, no, we appreciate the Band-Aids, but we don't want to do the major surgery. And I think we're scared, you know, if life is going well for us or life is working, we don't want to look within. You know, if your church is going well and you're successful and you're getting lots of affirmation, you're a large church pastor in Chicagoland and people love you, and your ways of doing things become paradigms for churches all over the world. Like, who wants to do their shadow work if it's going well?
Yeah.
And in fact, the narrative then becomes, well, I'm blessed. I mean, God's obviously blessing my ministry. I'm doing something right.
Right.
So there's no incentive.
Yeah. And it is unfathomable to me that a man can walk up on stage and have 30,000 people a week, like, listening to every word that he says. You know, like, people sit and listen to this, to these people, you know, half hour, 45 minutes a week. They don't listen to any one other thing maybe that long in a given week, you know?
We're all looking for someone to follow, right? I mean, this is why this goes back to Genesis 3. I mean, I think that's just it, is we're looking for someone who embodies a kind of ideal, like he's got it. Like, it's probably why I revered Jean Vanier for so long. You know, there's got to be someone who doesn't have the brokenness that I have in my life, someone who offers some sort of picture, paradigm of, you know, health and stability. And so if it's a mega church pastor in Chicago, you know, and his great things and his great spiritual life and his great values and his great marriage and his great this and his great that. And, you know, but we saw it in the Bible too, in Paul or Apollos. You know, who am I going to follow? You know, what movement is, or what podcast now? You know, I'm sure you have a following, and people who don't know you are like, wow, if only I could be like him, you know? Then finally, you know, and I'm sure you'd want to say, no, let's not go there.
that's very much what I want to say to everybody. Yes. But even as a pastor, you know, there is that sense in which it's easy to be inauthentic and almost, you know, can build a brand in a lot of ways.
It's interesting because now that I'm getting a little bit older, I've watched pastors who I went to seminary with who began to like gain a platform, and they were maybe a little bit more realistic and humble back then, but I see how it's sort of gone to their heads. And I remember for years tracking one of these guys that just sort of blew up and became larger than life and became this noted author and speaker and big church pastor, and just recognizing that and wondering, you know, what was going on behind the scenes until I found out what was going on behind the scenes. It's just devastating. Like, I knew you back in the day when, you know, we all were kind of talking about wanting to be humble and follow Jesus, and it's scary.
Yeah, it is. It's so disheartening. And I think you keep bringing up the scriptures and the people we see in the scriptures, and at the same time, there's like sort of nothing new under the sun. Like, we're still people, right?
Yeah, we're still people. There's nothing new under the sun. And these patterns have been on repeat since Genesis 3. I think this is why, because it's nothing new under the sun, the work that we have to do is nothing new either. You know, I'm not proposing some new, you know, brand new grand scheme, some brand new paradigm. Like, here's finally the solution in 2020. It goes back to humility. It goes back to self-knowledge, you know, the classic kind of Christian understanding of self-knowledge, knowing oneself before God and before others. It goes back to honesty and repentance, you know, that if you and I were close friends and you came to me and said, Chuck, this is how you, you know, last week when we were in a meeting, this is how you hurt me and impacted me, then how do I respond? Do I become defensive and say, you know, actually, Curry, that's your issue. I mean, I've noticed that in you. Or do I say, well, tell me more about that. I'm curious. So do we show up with curiosity? Like, this isn't anything new. You're right about that. And that's that, in a way that strangely, that gives me hope that maybe we can return to some of the basic practices of the Christian church, confession. You know, we're in Lent right now. We begin Lent with, you are dust and to dust you shall return. You're fragile. You're broken. You're limited. I'm limited. You're limited. Okay. Well, that's a gift, you know?
Right.
Let's return to the basics.
Yeah. Well, I loved how in the book you brought up the great Christ hymn from Philippians 2 a couple of times in the early parts and in the epilogue. And it's just amazing that that whole Christ hymn is centered on this is how you ought to have relationships with one another, right? Be like Christ, you know? It's
yeah. Who did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, became nothing, you know? I mean, there's something about that, right? Like, how did we miss the point? And you know, I guess when I miss the point every day, multiple times a day, I have to remember, you know, like the main characters of the story often miss the point. You see how the disciples, after 3 years of being mentored by Jesus, which you think would have been a really great thing, you know, at the very end, comparing and competing and what about him? And what, you know, like, yeah, I know that I compare, compete. I'm an Enneagram 4, so there's lots of envy. So I'm always looking out at that person has so much more than I have. And I'm constantly coming up less than, missing something. Yeah. And that's after lots of money for therapists over the years.
Right.
Lots of prayer and lots of reading. So we all have a lot of work to do. It continues.
Yeah. Yeah. Indeed. By the grace of God, we continue in those things, right? So from a practical standpoint then, I mean, what if somebody listening here maybe thinks that they might be dealing with a narcissistic leadership in the church? I mean, what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good question. So, you know, the oftentimes the instinct is like, I want to confront that person or I want to, and I would hesitate. I would actually find someone to process what's going on with. And hopefully that is a person, a professional who is trained and trauma informed. And I got to say, I'm a therapist, but there are a lot of bad therapists out there who don't
get the
dynamics, you know?
It's so staggering.
Yeah. I've had many, many people come to me and say, no one's identified narcissism before, emotional abuse in my story before. And so find someone who knows about these kinds of things and then get to work dealing with how it impacts you. And then in and through that work, you can make decisions about whether or not you want to share it with someone else or write a letter or leave the church or whatever seems wise after doing some of that inner work, I think is it's just like essential for us to get to a place where we are self-aware and self-regulated and able to sort of proceed from a clear sense of motivation, a clear center.
Yeah. What would be, I appreciate that. It's such a hard, I mean, dealing with somebody who's a narcissist in leadership is just very, very complicated, right?
Yeah. It sure is. And this is why I want to say sort of like handle with care, right? I mean, I think I made the mistake of confrontation early on. And in my arrogance, I thought that I could take on leaders that I felt like were bullying me or making bad decisions. So don't make the same mistake I did. I think that had to do with some of my own arrogance, you know. I think that if I was receiving wiser counsel back then, someone would have said, just shut up, Chuck, and let's take care of you for a little while, and then you can decide whether or not you want to speak or step away.
But
we live in a confrontational culture, you know, where we feel like we've got to step in and save the day or save the institution. Do your own work first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good. And we're in a confrontational culture that likes to like maybe jab and then like step away, like run away, you know? And so there's a lack of, I think, probably dealing with the fallout a lot of times, right? We'd rather just get away.
And our default responses are oftentimes, if you're being abused or traumatized by a narcissist, trauma responses, fight, flight, fawn, freeze, you know? So if we can get to a place where we understand how your nervous system works and what your default responses are and how come you get kind of just numb when things happen, or how come you become the aggressor when things happen, then we can breathe through it. We can get present to what's going on inside and make wiser choices, hopefully from our center and not from a place of reactivity.
Yeah, no, that's great stuff. So how would you then talk to maybe somebody in leadership who maybe is dealing with addictions and, you know, or, you know, any of these kind of outworkings of this narcissism.
Yeah. So my first thing is to sort of assess their level of curiosity about what might be going on. You know, you can only go as far as they're willing to go with their own sense of courage and curiosity for the sake of self-awareness. Now, some of them will sort of feign that. I call it vulnerability, F-A-U-X, yeah. Not vulnerability, but fake vulnerability. It's sort of like, oh, yeah, Chuck, like if you knew how sinful I was, you know, and they even in that kind of weird voice, you know, and you could kind of sense it from a mile away. Like, I'm such a sinner. And I'll say, yeah, okay, tell me specifically about how your sin shows up. How did it show up yesterday? Well, I mean, you know, 10 years ago, I was addicted to this and that. Well, no, tell me yesterday in your relationship with your spouse, how did it show up? Mm-hmm. They never want to get to what's present right now, what's current right now. And so I have to assess their willingness to be vulnerable, to show up, to share with me what's going on, how they're hurting themselves and how they're hurting others. That's where I start. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes with narcissistic personality disorder, we don't get very far.
Right.
But having done these assessments for a long time, if you're on the spectrum of narcissism but not personality disorder, like you've got stylistic traits or something like that, you can certainly see people engage with curiosity and say, yeah, I know I show up in those ways and I don't want to. So what's a good pathway to, you know, to maturity for me? And I want to be hopeful. I've also seen a lot of that too, even for people with narcissistic traits.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's really helpful. And there is hope, right? And you end your book with such hope. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that will be for some a more controversial chapter because I think, you know, I know a couple of years ago I was in contact with someone on the other side of the world who ran an abuse advocacy agency. Right. And she'd call herself a Christian. And she, you know, she read some of my stuff and she said, hey, I can't follow you on social media anymore. We can't be in contact. I don't want to read your book because you refuse to see narcissists as incurable and wicked. And wouldn't even engage in some sort of dialogue about that to understand my perspective, you know, and just was so black and white. Like narcissism is this one thing. It's almost like a binary. You either have it or you don't. And once someone's in that box, it's over.
Right.
And I just and maybe, you know, you can maybe blame this on my Enneagram 4-ness. My world is a little bit more fuzzy and gray.
Sure.
But I think I see things in spectrums and not in binary tones, you know, and so I'm willing to be corrected on this too, but that's just my experience over a long time of doing this work.
Yeah, and again, it goes back to narcissistic sort of person. I mean, the personality disorders versus like spectrums, and like there's a lot of gray area there.
Right. Yeah,
that's good. So I have my own little thought here that I just want to pitch out to you and just see what you think about it. Okay, if that's all right with you.
Yeah, please do it.
Okay, so the whole point of this podcast is, right, that like all of our work matters, that everybody's work, no matter what they do in the world, is good and like builds God's kingdom in some way, right?
Okay, yeah.
But I find that churches, and I don't know, I don't have the historical perspective necessarily, but over the last maybe 100 years have become so insular and so about sort of like building a building and building a kingdom, you know, within the church, that we've neglected actually teaching people about how their work really matters, that all of God's work is contained within the church. Do you feel like maybe there's some like trends of this narcissism, like just even within the church structure, that's caused us to sort of lose this idea of like the common good and those sorts of ideas?
Absolutely. I think so. I think, and you're now naming structures. Like one of the things that I like to say, and I couldn't get down to this level of detail in the book, but I'm going to probably do a little bit more with this in videos and other things, but is when we talk about getting down to what's really sort of motivating a system to be narcissistic, and we get beneath the waterline of the iceberg, you know, and we probe beneath. Now we're getting past simplistic solutions and Band-Aid kinds of solutions. We go underneath. We have to start looking at patterns over time. Mm. Like, how has this shown up? Like, this has been a part of this organization for the last 20 years. Wow.
Right.
And we've had three leaders. And so why is this the case? And then when we go a step below that, we get to structures. structure, particular kinds of structures, like profoundly like hierarchical structures are often implicated in these kinds of things where, where people are low on the totem pole or high on the totem pole. And then even below that, we get to mental models, which is, this is all from Peter Senge's work, but then we get to like implicit beliefs about people and things and the church. And when we get down to mental models, for instance, that's when we get to like, but we're an egalitarian church, but then we get down to a mental model of no, actually, but we're misogynistic, you know,
right.
We call ourselves egalitarian, but we're actually misogynistic. So there are these multiple layers of sort of describing and diagnosing the depth of how narcissism is embedded in systems. And one of the things that I'm wondering about, and I'd be curious to get your thoughts as a pastor, right? You're a pastor, right? And, so here we're in the midst of a global pandemic right now. And what we've done, you know, we've been riding the wave, even the wave of the markets, right? And what we've done is pragmatic. It's worked. And everything changed in a matter of a couple of months here, you know?
Right.
And now all of our sense of we can do whatever we want to do and we can ride the wave of, you know, capitalism and consumerism.
Yeah.
Gone in a moment's notice, right?
Right. Yeah.
So I think it's going to change things. I think actually it's an invitation for us to interrogate our own narcissism in our systems and in ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, one of the more profound practices my family has done recently is we've begun Sabbath, 24-hour Sabbath, you know, weekly. And this this whole thing feels like a forced Sabbath almost, like, you know, that the world's like, I can't, or the earth is sort of like, I can't sustain what's been happening for so long that I need to like hit a reset button here.
You know? Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, at any moment we could get up, get out in our car, go and buy something in a store,
right.
Or go out to eat, or go visit our pastor, whatever it is, right? Everything's changed. And so, and I wonder for pastors too, I wonder what this is going to do for those pastors who are on the big stages, you know, or need the adoration of their fans and their flocks. And now we're called to service, you know, now we're called to that self-giving love of just making phone calls and checking in, and we don't have our adoring fans waiting for us every Sunday morning. I think it's going to be disruptive in ways that are potentially hopeful.
Yeah.
I say that my fingers are crossed, you know, in a Christian way. I think that's in the Bible somewhere.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. We're in an interesting position because we don't have a building. We're a mobile church. We've been around for 20 years, but have kind of kept that model going, and we can more easily flip to something like this than other churches can, you know, a little more flexible, but it, I love how creative it's had to make everyone, but especially churches. Like, we're doing stuff that like we should have been doing this whole time, like from a digital perspective, you know, even as a mobile church. I think it's gonna like, I agree. I think it's gonna change a lot of systems, honestly, for the good. So
It's challenging. So we'll see how it all unfolds. But I hope, you know, people as they're reading this narcissism book during it are like, okay, well, maybe I'm seeing some of my own stuff in a way that I maybe couldn't see before this happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is a reckoning that comes with being forced to do something like this, like stay in your house and, you know, being forced, losing this perception of control that we once had. Right.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not always a bad thing.
Yeah. I totally agree. So, well, Chuck, do you feel like we kind of covered the book and kind of hit the high points or what you want to,
you know? Yeah. So, we've talked about a lot, and I think, I'm grateful for our time. I think there's a lot more, that we could talk about.
Right.
And I'd be glad to come back on another time, but, I'm grateful for your work as a pastor in this time. You know, I mean, we can talk about narcissism at a kind of a high level, but the reality is that both of us, when we're done with this conversation, have to go care for people, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think I leave people with a challenge, and that's, I don't think that this is just about diagnosing narcissism in a kind of gotcha way. I think we have an opportunity to be ambassadors of health, of wholeness, of wholeheartedness in the most biblical sense of the word. And so that our churches, church systems, relationships, community groups, Christian organizations, culture at large can be healthier. And, you know, I think I talk about swimming in the waters of narcissism, and we see it in our politics and we see it in all sorts of different places. Right. But I do think this begins as we become more like Jesus, as we follow Jesus, in the path of humility. And, that comes at some cost to our egos. So I want to challenge people to do that hard work of engaging, even if it costs you something, you know, even if you experience some resistance, like, oh, no, I don't want to go here because this says something about me that I don't want to see. Press in and do the work. Let's become the church, you know, especially for a time like this.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. That's great. I appreciate that very much. So good stuff. Well, are you ready to jump into our final two questions?
Let's do it, Curry.
Okay, sweet. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Okay. Want to hear a crazy story?
I love crazy stories.
So I was a janitor at Long Island MacArthur Airport. I grew up on Long Island, New York. In fact, I used to have a nice thick New York accent, but that's gone away over the years. It's a little bit there, but I was a janitor in the airport. And I was cleaning a bathroom one day, and I had to clean the women's bathroom. And so I knocked on the door. Anyone in there? You know, nothing. Said it again, walked in, knocked on a stall. Anyone in there? No one's in there. And I was in the habit of like getting out some of my aggression by kicking in the stall doors and then like cleaning the toilets. And I kicked in, you know where this is going, kicked in the stall door, and someone screams, and I ran out. So that's my strangest job and story of that job.
That is a great story. Okay. I just got to tell you, I don't know that I've ever told maybe anyone this story, but I worked at Blockbuster and we had to like lock the bathrooms, you know, I was in high school or whatever. And you know, you would unlock the bathroom for a customer and then go back. Right. So you never really knew who was in there or whatever. And they had no ability to lock once they were inside. So I did the same thing. I just like a customer needed the bathroom, walked in, unlocked it. And this lady just started screaming and I just ran away. It was like,
Yeah.
We're like twinning there, you know, it's awesome.
And winning.
So.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
Good. Okay. So my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
Yeah. Great question. I spent a number of years out in San Francisco, and we started something called the Newbegin Fellows Program out there after the British missionary theologian, Leslie Newbegin.
Oh, so good. Yeah.
And it was for lay people, you know, who were trying to figure out what does it mean to show up as a Christian in my workplace, you know. And more often than not for them, it was like, don't cuss, don't steal pencils, don't like, you know, be nice, be kind, whatever it is. But I'll say, you know, I think that at the very core, they learned what presence meant, becoming the curious, compassionate, loving presence of Jesus to a neighbor. A non-reactive, non-defensive, non-anxious presence that actually piques people's curiosity. And so while I could say a lot about this, I have a lot of thoughts about what it means to show up in our workplaces. I think when we show up as people who are truly present to the needs of others, when we show up as fully human, people experience us as different, you know? And that's not an opportunity to say, well, I'm fully human because I'm a Christian and you should become a Christian too, you know?
Right.
But when we tangibly show up for our neighbors in a culture where we're so busy, we're workaholics, we're so disconnected, we're so not present. I think, like I was talking about that, becoming ambassadors earlier, becoming ambassadors of presence, really showing up in a world where we're so often not present to one another. Is a really sort of fundamental value of mine when it comes to showing up in our workplaces.
Yeah, that's really good stuff. I appreciate that. The presence and being like Jesus, who was the most human person who's ever lived, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Show up like Jesus in a way that sees beyond, sees the image of God in another. When it's so easy to say, that guy in the, you know, the cubicle next to me is just an idiot. You know, his breath smells and he always stinks of coffee, you know?
Right.
How do we see the image of God in another? Yeah.
Amen. Amen. Such good stuff. Chuck, man, this was super fun. I enjoyed it.
Thanks so much for the invitation. Grateful for your work.
for sure. Thank you for the book, and I love what you got going on. So, yeah, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Chuck. I just encourage you, check out this book. It's a really great read. It's really helpful, I think, for all of life, not just in the church context, because there are narcissists everywhere, and we are going to come across them and come across some of those tendencies. So I just encourage you to do that. Check out his book. He's got a lot of great content on his website. His social media is always super helpful. I found him to be inspirational on Twitter. Just some like really great concepts around a lot of topics. So make sure you're following him in all those places. And right now is a great time to scroll to the bottom of your iTunes app and leave me a rating and review. It's really easy. It just takes a couple of minutes, and it just helps get the word out about the podcast. That is greatly appreciated. Thanks for doing that a ton. It means a lot. And until next time, get out there or stay in and hustle.